Chapter 5. It was an ugly scene. By the time all the units got there, it was already over. The squad that spotted Stalker had picked him up near Grant and Orchard and had given pursuit, following him down to the Manhattan Bridge. Stalker fled from them, and they thought they had him on the run. But then he turned it all around on them. As Steele stood next to the melted and charred remains of one of the armored Strike Force pursuit vehicles, he could almost see how the action had played out. Stalker had managed to stay just ahead of them, leading them down near the waterfront beneath the elevated highway. Then he had turned and fought, taking out one vehicle with a plasma burst that charred and melted the SFP, superheating the pursuit car, and cooking the unfortunate occupants as if they had been trapped inside an oven. Then the fuel cells had exploded, and what was left of it was nothing more than a charred and smoking hulk, flames still licking from it, surrounded by partly melted pieces of shrapnel. He had taken out the other SFP as well, and its remains were embedded in the front of an abandoned building, where it had crashed an instant before exploding. The armored van had also failed to escape destruction. The men inside had managed to get out just before the plasma hit, but they never had a chance to deploy. Some of them had been caught in the wash of plasma flame, and they lay on the ground, being given woefully inadequate first aid by their fellow officers, who had arrived on the scene too late to help them. Others had been cut down by Stalker's laser. Some had died instantly. Others lay upon the cracked and buckled street, their bodies crushed. The paramedic choppers came in and landed on the street, disgorging men in white jumpsuits with stretchers. It looked like a war zone. "Christ, they never had a chance," said Lieutenant Volkirk, the commander of the federal squad that had just arrived on the scene. He looked at the burning wreckage of the SFPs. "How the hell do we stop a thing that can do that?" Then he realized what he had said and gave Steele a quick, embarrassed glance. "Sorry, Lieutenant, I didn't mean that the way it sounded." "Forget it," said Steele. He was aware that a lot of the men were trying pointedly to not look at him. This was what happened when a cyborg ran out of control. "He took their weapons," said Martinez, another one of the officers. "Hell, it's not as if he was undergunned. Look at this, for Christ's sake." "Maybe he's running low on ammo," said Sergeant Keneally. "How many plasma charges does he have?"
"I don't know," said Steele. "We don't have any documentation on his mods. He destroyed the data when he wiped out the lab, but he can't have an indefinite supply."
"Maybe he didn't take them for himself," said Keneally, a veteran Strike Force cop. They looked at him.
"What do you mean?"
Volkirk said.
Keneally looked grim. "Here, if he decided to recruit himself an army, it's not as if there'd be any shortage of volunteers."
"Christ, that's all we need," Volkirk said.
Steele frowned.
"If you wanted to score yourself a lot of weapons fast, and you had the kind of ordnance that Stalker has, where would you go?"
Keneally gave him a sharp glance.
"I hit the gangs," he said.
"This is green dragon turf," said Martinez. "Only, how would he find them? They never keep their headquarters in the same location, and they're spread out all over the damn place."
"He'd do exactly what his name implies," said Steele. "He'd stalk them, like a guerrilla fighter. Mick often said that's just what we should do. Identify the gang members and take them out one at a time, or in groups of two and three, instead of trying to catch them in the act of breaking the law. Just hunt them down. Put the fear of God into them."
"I don't think God had anything to do with this," said Keneally, looking at the carnage, at his fellow officers being loaded into the choppers.
"You couldn't have gotten far," said Steele. "Concentrate all units in this area. I'm betting he's going to hit the dragons and either take the ordnance or force them to follow him. It's not the gangs he's after. It's me."
"Why you?" said Volkirk. "You guys were partners."
"Yeah," said Steele. "Maybe that's why. Mick Taylor's not Mick Taylor anymore. He's gone insane. He thinks I'm to blame for what happened to him. Keneally, I had to leave my place in one hell of a hurry. And after seeing what he's done here, I'm going to need more ordnance. I'll take your squad. You take my chopper and get back to my place. Tell Raven I'll need my full battle mods. She'll know what to give you. Then get back to me as soon as possible."
"Right, I'm on my way."
"Shut. It's as if things weren't bad enough," said Volkirk.
He was looking up as a news chopper came in for a landing, and Linda Tellerman came out, followed by her cameraman. She was dressed in a blue flight suit with her station's logo stitched over her breast.
"You want me to head her off?" asked Volkirk.
"Yeah, stall her till I'm out of here," said Steele. "I don't have time for this right now."
Another station's news chopper was hovering overhead, undoubtedly filming the scene of the battle, while two more news cars came screeching up.
Lieutenant Steele!
Shouted Linda Tellerman as Volkirk came up to her. Steele moved quickly to the chopper that had brought McKitt and Keneally's squad.
Mount up,
he said to Keneally's second-in-command, Sergeant Fossey. Fossey spoke into his helmet mic, and the troops came running. Steele got into the chopper and moved up to sit next to the pilot.
Let's get out of here,
he said. The battered gypsy cab pulled over to the curb at the corner of 110th and 5th, near the northeast end of Central Park. The big black man got in the front seat, beside the driver. He was well over 6 feet tall, with the powerful frame of a bodybuilder. His 24-inch arms strained the fabric of his custom-made black leather sport coat, and his chest was huge, with wide, flaring lats that tapered down to a slim, muscular waist. He shaved his head, and he wore dark, black-rimmed sunglasses. The driver of the cab was a grizzled old black man, skinny as a rake, with a deeply lined face and white stubble on his chin. He wore a shapeless, floppy leather cap and a windbreaker over a dark red sweatshirt, printed with dripping black letters that spelled out, Sex and Violence. His name was Slim, and in his younger days, he had been the leader of a Harlem street gang called the Skulls. The huge mountain of a man beside him had taken over the leader of the Skulls when Slim got too old to run a street gang and retired. His physical appearance in his badly dented gypsy cab gave no clue to Slim's true financial status. Slim was more than comfortable. He was one of the most successful independent pimps in no man's land, with a small, exclusive stable of beautiful young girls who doted on him like a favorite uncle. Don't like that phrasing. Unlike most pimps, he treated his girls well and took good care of them. They didn't have to walk the streets. Slim had a well-heeled white clientele, which didn't mind paying extra for cab service to and from the apartment building where he kept his girls right on the edge of no man's land.
What you been doing, Ice?
Said Slim in a husky, gravelly voice.
Fed Street, and you're right.
It always amused Slim to no end that the scrappy youngster he had taken under his wing when he was leader of the Skulls had become a federal agent, given full amnesty, a job, and a luxurious apartment in exchange for his assistance in helping Steele take down Victor Borodini.
I got no complaints,
said Ice. When he spoke, he sounded like the voice of doom. His voice was deep and resonant, and anybody hearing it without actually seeing him, such as over the phone, knew immediately that it came from something big. Ice reached into his jacket pocket and took out a small photograph. He handed it to Slim.
Seen this girl around?
Working girl,
asked Slim, taking the photo of Corey Steele.
That's what I hear,
said Ice. Slim examined the photo.
Young blood, haven't seen her. Mind if I ask what your interest is?
Personal,
said Ice.
The girl be Steele's daughter.
Slim gave a low whistle.
Oh boy, someone done bought into one pack of trouble. Her player know who she is?
I doubt it,
said Ice.
Otherwise, he crazy.
She strung out?
Don't know. Last time she be seen, it be right here on this corner.
Slim shook his head.
This ain't nobody's private strip, said Slim. She working it?
Meeting someone. Her brother. She wanted out, but her player showed up and beat the tar out of the kid. Messed him up good.
So the kid saw him then?
Yeah, but he ain't in no shape to talk about it. Soon as I get me a description, I get back to you.
Steele out looking for her now?
Ice shook his head.
Steele got much bigger problems.
More important than his little girl.
Ice turned to face Slim slowly.
Man ain't got no choice,
he said.
Raven say he torn up about it pretty bad. I looking into this on his behalf. I owe the man.
I'll see what I can do,
said Slim. He held up the photo.
Can I keep this?
Do that.
Okay, I get right on it. What's her name?
Corey.
What happens if I find her? You want me to talk to her main man? Convince him he be making a big mistake? He don't let her go?
He already made a big mistake,
said Ice.
You find her, you stay out of it. Call me.
You got it.
Thanks, Slim,
said Ice. He reached for his wallet.
Hey, son, you're not gonna insult me, are you?
Ice took his hand out of his jacket.
That's better,
Slim said.
Go on, get out of here. I got work to do.
There were many places in the city where the creatures from the underworld could come up from their tunnels. Most of them were deep in no man's land, the ghetto ruins surrounding Midtown. The mortality rate in no man's land was high. People often disappeared. Mothers cried at night over their lost children, knowing they'd never be seen again. The unfortunates who lived in no man's land were trapped by poverty and circumstance in a desolate existence that offered no hope for improvement and not much for survival. Many of them were already dead, though their bodies hadn't realized it yet. They shambled through the streets, fueled by drugs, booze, and insanity, no longer caring if the hammer fell or not. And many of them were mean, taught by the dictates of survival in the urban jungle to scratch and claw for their existence like savage beasts. The green dragons were among the meanest of the lot. Many, though by no means all, of them were Asian. The dragons were the linear descendants of the gangs that once ruled Chinatown. They controlled the makeshift economy of their blasted section of the ghetto. They controlled the shabby little businesses. They controlled the prostitution. They controlled the crime. They got a cut of everything that happened on their turf, and if they didn't, it soon ceased to happen. Permanently. At one time, they had become under the control of Victor Borodini, head of the most powerful crime enclave on Long Island. There had been no need for Victor Borodini to subdue them to his will. He was, as he often styled himself, a businessman, and he had simply offered them a deal that they could not refuse. From his dealings with the freebooters and with corrupt politicians, Borodini had almost unlimited access to two commodities that were highly valued on the Dragon's turf: guns and drugs. He promised to supply them with all that they needed in return for a modest percentage of their action and an occasional job he wanted done. The Dragons had thought it was good business, and for a while, it had been. But now that the Borodini enclave was in federal hands and Victor Borodini in hiding, the Dragons were once more on their own. They had been approached by Borodini's men, but they were no longer interested. They had plenty of guns, cash throughout their turf, and there were no shortage of illegal drugs. The Delano family, from Brooklyn, had wasted little time in taking up the slack. Anthony Delano had no political axe to grind. He only wanted profit. So the deal was not quite as attractive as the one that Victor Borodini offered them. There was no percentage action. It was just straight business. Buy and sell. But that was okay, too. It was still good business. Three of the Dragons walked together down the cracked and buckled sidewalk, heading for their clubhouse. They moved the clubhouse often, just to keep the cops off balance. Unlike the Skulls up in North Harlem, they didn't stick to the same places, daring the Strike Force cops to come in and try to get them. The Dragons were craftier. They stayed mobile. They never kept all their action in one place, and only the members knew where the next meeting would be held. The three young toughs all carried Chinese AK-47s. In the days before the Boer War, there had been a flood of such weapons coming into the States from Beijing, manufactured in factories scattered throughout China, and exported to the European and American civilian markets. They were well-made and relatively inexpensive compared to similar European and domestic ordnance, the result of cheap, skilled labor with minimal automation. And the Kalashnikov design was strong and reliable. They were also fairly easily convertible to illegal, fully automatic fire. Through Victor Borodini, the Dragons had gotten hold of a large shipment of them, stored for years in warehouses in the South and picked up by some freebooter. They also had Chinese copies of the US M14 and the Russian Tokarev pistol. Nor was that the only ordnance available to the street gangs in no man's land. In the years before the Boer War, there had been a concentrated effort to ban firearms, especially handguns. Fully automatic weapons were the first to go, largely because it was difficult, if not impossible, for a case to be made for their use as sporting arms. Consequently, first came stringent licensing requirements, then an outright ban. Then came the ban on so-called assault rifles, semi-automatic weapons based on military designs, since they were capable of being fitted with large-capacity magazines and could be illegally altered to fully automatic function. Small handguns were the next to be legislated against. Christened Saturday Night Specials, a name originally coined to apply to cheaply made, inexpensive, small-caliber handguns, the term was gradually expanded to apply to any short-barreled handgun that was easily concealable, regardless of design or price or quality of manufacture. The argument was made that the only conceivable purpose for such weapons was to kill people, since they were of no practical use in hunting and not accurate enough for target shooting. Consequently, it was stated that no one except police and military personnel had any business owning them. Larger handguns were the next logical step, and banning them was easier once the other weapons were prohibited. After all, a .44 Magnum or a .357 with a 6-inch barrel could still be concealed beneath a coat or jacket. The result of all this supposedly well-intentioned legislation was a booming black market in illegal weapons, either imported or illegally manufactured domestically. It was similar to what happened during the days of Prohibition, when anyone who possessed a bathtub could make gin. The manufacture of a firearm was not a very complicated process. Anyone with a well-set up machine shop could turn out illegal weapons, and there was a proliferation of them in varying degrees of quality. And the drug runners found another lucrative commodity to deal in. For that matter, any kid could make a zip gun from a broken car antenna, some electrician's tape, a rubber band, and a block of wood. All the legislation managed to accomplish was take guns out of the hands of law-abiding citizens. It affected criminals not at all, and did not significantly alter crime statistics. What it did was create a new and highly profitable illegal industry. The crime families went into the arms business in a big way, and just as with drugs, many of their illegally manufactured products were soon well known by evocative street names: Jaguar, Kodiak, Demon, Viper, and many others. After the Bio-War, when a beleaguered populace forced the repeal of the gun laws, many of the gunleggers became legitimate, among them companies such as American Small Arms and Mongoose Industries. Throughout history, whenever there was a demand, there was always rose inevitable outlets of supply, and the street gangs had a wide array of firearms to choose from. In addition to their AK-47s, the three young men also carried 9mm, Viper machine pistols and large holsters on their belts, along with several spare magazines holding 20 rounds apiece. Over their street gang colors, they wore weapons harnesses, incorporating a shoulder holsters for semi-automatic pistols. One of them carried a .45 caliber Demon, the other two had a 9mm Mongoose, along with magazine pouches and nylon sheaths for their commando knives. The three gang members looked like a cross between mercenaries and Caribbean pirates. Aside from their colors, black denim vests brilliantly embroidered with the design of a green Chinese dragon on the back, they wore loose black martial arts trousers or camel fatigues tucked into paratrooper boots, bright sweatshirts or no shirts at all, long hair held in place by colorful silk scarves rolled up into their headbands, earrings, studded bracelets, rings, chains, amulets, and intricate Chinese tattoos. It was starting to grow dark as they sauntered arrogantly down the street, but they were confident that they were well enough equipped to deal with any threat they might encounter. They were wrong. Stalker dropped down from a second-story window, landing right behind them. As they spun around, he grabbed the rifle from the nearest one and smashed its butt into the dragon's face, bursting flesh and pulverizing bone. He kicked out with his foot and broke the second dragon's kneecap. The young man cried out and collapsed into the sidewalk. The third one brought up his AK-47, but he never had the chance to fire. Stalker fired the rifle he'd grabbed from his first victim, and the dragon flew backward as a spray of bullets caught him in the chest. Then Stalker turned back to the dragon with the broken knee. The young man had dropped his rifle, and it now lay out of reach. Grimacing with pain, he pulled out his magazine pistol, or his machine pistol, and fired point blank, emptying the magazine. Stalker jerked and staggered back as the bullet struck him in the chest, but they didn't put him down. The dragon held his empty weapon and stared with disbelief as the man kept coming at him. He fumbled for a spare magazine, but as he tried to insert into the machine pistol, Stalker bent down and easily plucked the weapon from his grasp, tossing it behind him. As the dragon tried to reach for the pistol in his shoulder holster, Stalker grabbed his hand and squeezed. There was a crunching, crackling sound, and the dragon screamed with pain as his hand was crushed. Stalker released his mangled hand and grabbed the weapon's harness. He gave a sharp yank, and the dragon cried out as the harness broke. Stalker turned around and tossed it to one of the shabby men behind him, along with the captured rifle. The dragon noticed them for the first time. It was as if they had come out of nowhere. They were bending over the bodies of his friends and relieving them of their weapons. Then, to his horror, they started to drag the bodies away, a hungry look in their bright, demented eyes. Stalker bent down over him.
"Where's the meeting?"
he said. The dragon didn't answer. Stalker reached out with one finger and popped the dragon's left eye out of its socket, then tore it loose. The dragon's agonized scream echoed through the streets. Stalker held the eye up.
"I said, where's the meeting?"
Blood leaking down his face, the dragon shook his head. "No, please! No more! I'll tell you!" The dragon told him. Stalker straightened up and turned to the disheveled men gathered behind him.
"He's all yours."
"No! No, no! Please! No!" Throat-rending scream echoed through the streets as the derelicts descended on their victim, like a pack of hungry wolves. Then it was cut off abruptly. Hey there, me again. It's about to get rough again, so be prepared. "Come on, let's go," said Rico. "I've got a special customer for you tonight. He likes him young and tender."
"No,"
said Corey, staring fully at the floor.
"I'm not going."
"What was that?"
"You heard me,"
she said tonelessly.
"Not going. I can't do it anymore. I won't. It's disgusting."
Rico's eyes glittered as he stared down at her. He stood over her, dressed in a long black cabretta leather coat, black suede boots with high spike heels, skin-tight black lycra pants, and a flowing, ruffled white shirt, open at the neck to reveal a dozen gold chains and amulets. His black hair was streaked with silver, and it hung down to his shoulders. At first glance, he could easily have been mistaken for a woman. He was very pretty, with olive skin and dark almond eyes. He wore a dangling silver crucifix in his left ear, and his hands were studded with gold and diamond rings. He lashed out suddenly, giving her a stinging slap across her face and tangling his fingers in her long blonde hair. She cried out as he pulled her off to the bed and dragged her to the floor by her hair, getting down on one knee beside her, bringing his perfumed face close to hers.
"You'll do what I tell you, bitch!" he snarled. "Or do you want more of what you got the last time?"
Corey gasped with pain and blinked back tears.
"I don't care,"
she said defiantly.
"I don't care what you do to me. I'm not going to do it anymore. It's ugly. It's disgusting."
"You're ugly,"
Rico hissed, putting his face up close to hers and yanking sharply on her hair.
"You're disgusting. You're nothing but a common little tramp, a slut. You'll do what I tell you, you little whore, or I'll rip your goddamn lungs out."
He let go of her hair and slapped her once again. Corey huddled on the floor, sobbing.
"You'll be sorry,"
she said.
"You just wait. You'll be sorry when my daddy finds you."
"Your daddy?"
he said with derision.
"Oh, good lord. Your daddy's
probably been putting it to you since you were 9. Nope. Don't like that."
"He has not,"
cried Corey, tears streaming down her face.
"He's going to get you for what you've done to me. You'll be sorry. He's a cop. A strike force cop."
Rico snorted.
"Is he now?"
"His name's Lieutenant Steele, and he's the best cop on the force. He'll find you, and he'll make you pay."
"Steele?"
Rico said, his eyes growing wide.
"Not Lieutenant Donovan Steele."
"That's right,"
said Corey.
"If you don't let me go, he'll find you, and he'll kill you."
"Shut up,"
Rico said, backhanding her viciously across the face. Corey cried out again and huddled in a little ball on the floor, her arms up over her head as she sobbed. Rico stared down at her for a long moment and turned to one of the other girls.
"You'll do her trick tonight,"
he said.
"Sure, baby. Anything you say."
Rico went over to the phone. He picked it up and dialed.
"This is Rico," he said. "Let me talk to Ricky B. Tell him it's important. Real important."
He waited a moment.
"Mr. Morandini, how you doing?" "Yeah, I said it was important. You'll be glad I called. I got a surprise for you. A real big surprise."
He glanced over at Corey, huddled on the floor, and smiled. The lab on level B3 of the federal building was a bustle of activity. The wreckage caused by Stalker when he'd broken out had been removed, and new equipment was being brought in. With crews working around the clock, most of the physical damage had already been repaired, and teams of technicians were busily at work installing new programs and trying to retrieve the damaged data. Higgins watched Dr. Jennifer Stone, who had been brought out from Los Alamos to replace the late Dr. Philip Gates. She was young, in her mid-30s, a redhead with bright green eyes, who was uncomfortably pretty, though she took no pains to emphasize her beauty. But then, she didn't need to, Higgins thought. She looked much better than her photograph, which caused Higgins to raise his eyebrows when he looked over her file. Dev Cooper had worked with her at Los Alamos, and he had a very high opinion of her. Almost too high. The fuck does that mean? "Was there ever anything personal between you?" Higgins had asked, watching Cooper carefully. David smiled and shook his head. "Nah," he said. "But it wasn't for lack of trying. She's a real knockout, ain't she? But I don't think I was her type." "What is her type?" said Higgins. "I don't really know," said Dev. "Maybe she doesn't have one. Hell, just about every guy in the project took his best shot at one time or another, and even the married ones. But so far as I know, she never gave any of them a tumble. Some thought she might be gay, but there was no real indication of it. She's a real discreet, keeps her personal life personal." Higgins had nodded. "That speaks well of her. What about her attitude? She's a team player, Or is she the independent sort, like you? Devin chuckled. She's very, very serious, he said. Aggressive, ambitious, and thoroughly professional. If you're looking, asking if she'll rock the boat, I'd say that should be the least of your worries. Politically, she's almost as much of a fascist as you are. In other words, I don't think you'll have to worry about her being lax about security. She ran her section of the lab like a Gestapo colonel. Really? Higgins said. Her file is impressive. The most impressive of all the candidates we've screened. So you think she'd fit in well? Oh, she'll fit in all right, said Dev. But if you don't watch your ass, she'll have your job within a year. Higgins had called her personally to offer the job. When he had asked her how soon she might get here, she said she'd be on the next flight. She was. She'd arrived with just one suitcase, but so far as Higgins knew, she hadn't even seen the apartment he'd arranged for her yet. She moved into her office, which she had once belonged to Gates, and used the bathroom and shower facilities in the gym. She had plunged right in immediately, taking charge like a commando, and anyone who didn't give 100% heard the whip cracked and snapped to. Higgins was impressed. She saw him watching her and came over. Something, she said. Just came down to see how you were doing. We're making good progress, she said. It's still too early to tell if we'll be able to retrieve all the damage data, but we're working on it. Any word from the people in the field? The field. She meant the streets. She even talked like a commando, Higgins thought. Yeah, and it's not good, he said. Stalker was spotted by one of the strike force units. They engaged pursuit, and he took them out so fast they didn't even know what hit him. And now you've lost him once again. She nodded curtly. Gates did good work, she said. Too bad he was so sloppy about keeping backup records. Gates was a brilliant man, but he was sloppy about a lot of things, said Higgins. When you get a chance, there's something I'd like for you to check out for me. Is it important? I've got a lot to do here. It could be, I'm not sure, said Higgins. You seen Dr. Cooper yet? Yes, he stopped by briefly. She paused. He looks like hell. He's been under a lot of strain, said Higgins. Is that what happens to people on this project? She said. They either get killed or fall apart. I'm still here and in one piece, said Higgins with a smile. Because you have other people do the dirty work? Maybe. You say what's on your mind, don't you? Not always, but when it helps save time. What's bugging Dev? He's one of the most stable, centered people I've ever known, but it's obvious he's been drinking heavily, and I also think he's taking drugs. He shows all the signs. I've seen that sort of thing before. It has to do with Steel, Higgins said, and with that problem I just mentioned to you. If it's doing that to him, then it must be one hell of a problem, she said. I don't want to take any time away from what you're doing here, said Higgins, but I'd appreciate your input on this. She pursed her lips thoughtfully. You want to be around tonight? Late, I mean. I can be. Good. I'll be sending some of my people around 10. I've got them working shifts, but we've got a hole in the schedule between 10 and 4 to allow the work crews time to finish up and install the rest of the equipment. I'll meet you in your office at 10:30, if that will be convenient. That will be fine. You working straight through? There's a lot to do. We don't want to wear you out, said Higgins. Don't worry, you won't. It was almost 1 o'clock in the morning when Jennifer got up from the computer in Higgins' office. She didn't look in the least bit tired, despite the fact that she'd been on her feet since 4 a.m. Her green eyes were bright with excitement. This is fantastic, she said. Dev was right. It is self-aware. You're absolutely sure, said Higgins, frowning. Beyond a doubt, she said. Dev Cooper couldn't have done this. Not even with the help of someone like Gates. The program is alive. It's responding in a completely human manner. It thinks. It's got a personality. Steele's personality, said Higgins. Cooper talks to it. He talks to it? Through a VS peripheral, Higgins said. Gates programmed it for him, made it sound like Steele. Of course, she said. It makes perfect sense. Dev's a psychiatrist. He'd be able to relate to it much easier that way. Christ, no wonder he's such a wreck. Do you have any idea what this means?
I'm not sure I do, exactly, Higgins said.
It means you have the capability to duplicate human intelligence, she said excitedly. It's an absolutely shattering scientific breakthrough. Gates must have been blind not to have realized what you had here. Either that, or he simply didn't want to see it.
Why wouldn't he want to see it? Higgins asked, puzzled.
Maybe it was subconscious, she said. A function of self-preservation. Dev Cooper saw it, and look what it's done to him. It's made him a nervous wreck.
Yeah, Cooper said something like that, but it doesn't seem to have disturbed you all that much, said Higgins.
Are you kidding? Look at me. I'm practically shaking. This is the most exciting thing that's ever happened to me. I'm on an incredible adrenaline high. You've got to let me work on this.
I still don't fully understand, said Higgins. Slow down a little and explain it to me. Have a drink?
Vodka, she said. Straight and neat.
Coming right up, he went over to the bar in his office. She was pacing back and forth, running her fingers through her hair. She was incredibly wired.
The implications of this are mind-boggling, she said. There's practically no limit to what you can do with something like this.
Give me a for instance, he said, handing her her drink. He took his usual scotch, sat down, and lit a cigarette. He offered her one, and she took it, inhaling on it maniacally.
How would you like to be in several dozen places at the same time, she said, running several different operations simultaneously. In effect, with this, you could. You could clone yourself electronically and operate out of computers in different parts of the country, all networked together, reporting to you right here in your office. What we've been doing in Los Alamos, what you've started here, is only the tip of the iceberg. I can't believe it never occurred to any of us to try this. She shook her head. But it is so far-fetched. It was staring us straight in the face all along, and we just didn't see it. God, how stupid. We've only been experimenting with downloading limited bits of information, being typically conservative, taking tiny little steps. Gates, God bless him, took a giant leap and outdistanced us all. We've all been suffering from tunnel visions. We've been too cautious. Jesus! She emptied her glass and came around to the front of the desk, resting her hands on it and bending forward toward him, her eyes dancing with excitement. What Gates did was to download all the information from Steele's brain and store it so it totally could program back into the cybernetic brain that you gave Steele. And being the engineer he was, he kept a backup. But he never did anything with it. That's what's so amazing. He never explored the possibilities. He kept just one. He never thought of it as any more than just another piece of software. He was wedded to the idea that it was the hardware, the cybernetic brain that made it work, but a computer can make it work equally well because it doesn't matter. The software is a thing, a mental engram matrix, alive and self-aware. And you can make copies of it, limitless copies. You can take one Steele and create an army of them, with the same personality, all capable of interaction, all thinking and responding. In the same way, you could do it with anyone, soldiers, scientists, political leaders, corporate executives. Do you see where it can lead?
Higgins gave a low whistle. That never even occurred to me, he said.
Never occurred to anyone else who knew about this either, she said, except Dev Cooper. You all became so caught up in the Steele project that you never realized that the original aim of Project Download has been realized. This is it. You succeeded, Higgins. You pulled it off. You've created the ultimate synthesis of human computer intelligence. And I'm right here on the ground floor. It's the opportunity of a lifetime. I could kiss you for giving me this job.
Higgins stared at her. Her thick red hair was in disarray. Her eyes were bright. She was practically glowing with energy and excitement. I wouldn't stop you, he said.
She stared at him. Then she suddenly reached across the desk, grabbed him by his necktie, and roughly pulled him close to her. Their lips met, and her mouth opened, her tongue eagerly seeking his. She sat down on the desk and lay back, pulling him down with her, her fingers clutching roughly at his hair. Things fell off the desk, and he bent down over her, running his hands over her lush body, down to her legs and up to her dress. They wasted no time with preliminaries. They were both out of control. He had her right there on the desk, with her dress up around her waist and her long legs wrapped around him. All the while, the screen on the computer glowed. They didn't notice when several of the other screens came across. When several of the other screens across the room in the large wall console came on suddenly and started flashing data at an astonishingly rate, they didn't notice when the surveillance camera mounted near the ceiling in the corner of the room suddenly pivoted around and focused on them. Another screen in the wall console came on, showing them locked together, kissing passionately and thrusting against each other. And then, one by one, the screens winked out. But the camera remained focused upon them. End of chapter.